Hi, this is Paul. Is there such a thing as natural human sexuality? I don't think so, and I don't think there can be, by virtue of our definition of natural. If you say that fossil fuel climate change is unnatural, then anything touched by cognition is by definition unnatural. Unnatural has come to mean something which has been manipulated or changed by human cognition or human intentional ability or agency. That's basically what we view the term as. But our use of that term is very inconsistent. Now, I think a lot of this comes by our scientific quest for the universal. And we get that by, well, one of my favorite videos, Daniel Bonavac's lecture from a few years ago. I need to get this right here. On normativity. And basically, we look around and see, we say gravity is normative. Gravity is normative in Sacramento. It's normative in Detroit. It's normative in Uzbekistan. It's normative in China. All around the world, gravity is normative. And then we give calculations of gravity on other planets, but gravity is normative. And in fact, I was listening to a great courses on philosophy and the fact that part of what destroyed the discarded image is that Galileo and everyone else began to believe that the laws of physics are the same in the world and in the heavens. And at that point, the entire edifice fell down. Now, this is, of course, the ultimate scientific trick to exclude conscious agents in discerning natural processes. If I drop a ball from a tower in Italy and measure how long it takes that ball to hit the earth, or if I drop two balls, it doesn't matter how much I sit there and wish for one ball to drop less or to drop more, those balls are impervious to my wishing. And the entire scientific enterprise is premised on the idea that there's somehow some firewall between my wishing and things that happen out there in the physical world. That's the whole premise. And in fact, that premise is behind all kinds of doubt and suspicion, behind things like prayer. Even though we still have wishing on a star, we have Dumbo's feather, we have all of these things, this is the idea. We're looking for universality. But to find this in human beings, well, this is a very big quest of ours. Even if early scientists believed that actually the balls always fall at the same rate because God wills it such, that was based on their theological assumption that, in fact, God is so utterly reliable that, well, God doesn't change. You'll find Christians saying that and believing that all over the place. But yet we're looking for the universal because we want to imagine that if we can find the universal, well then what? Well, then we can move around the physical things of the world in order to achieve the outcomes we desire. But if you watched my last video, this quest for the things that we desire, well, that's also within us. And so then we have all these types of ways of figuring out, well, why do we desire what we desire? Now, it's very interesting, if you look around our culture, the deep belief in the natural being the normative, natural foods, even organic foods. But if you just look at this picture from the Sacramento Natural Foods Co-op, there's really nothing natural about that room. All of those foods have been, I've made this point before, you know what natural apples look like, natural corn looks like. None of those foods look like they are found in nature, meaning apart from human agency or human manipulation. What do they mean by natural foods? We don't eat natural foods at all. But the idea that, well, what we've been doing is hurting ourselves by, dare I say, monkeying with our food supply and all of these things has led us into a bad place. So if we only eat natural foods and live a natural life, then life will be better somehow. And we're not really quite sure about better. And as I've made the point before, everybody's looking at, well, I'm looking for personal growth and development, yet people are really hard-pressed to say where that growth and development goes or what it is. Now, this is all a big faith because, well, if you look at least guesstimates about life expectancy, our unnatural lifestyles of modernity seem, I don't know, on one hand, quite a bit supposedly better than the natural lifestyles that we're supposedly looking to for normativity. What, in fact, is the natural state of a human being? Now, in Lawrence Krauss's conversation with Jordan Peterson, Krauss sort of waves all this away by saying, well, anything that we talk about with human beings is just a tiny little blip in the span of the entire cosmos. Okay, so are human beings natural at all? You know, time and nature seem to, in some ways, be competing here, even though a lot of what we're looking for from nature is sort of a development of natural time. Sorry for the volume bump. Won't happen again. I just always forget to reset the volume after I do a Zoom call, so you won't have to readjust your sound again. Now, this is a picture here of celebrity mugshots, and there's a lovely picture of Glenn Campbell looking not at all happy to have been arrested, and other people, Nick Nolte, not looking his best either. It's just very funny when we ask, well, what is our natural state? And what's interesting is that our natural state is no state any of us living today could ever achieve, if you imagine human beings, natural is defined by somehow untouched by human agency, human consciousness, or human will. That, or simply dismissing all human agency, consciousness, and will, sort of like Sam Harris, as in fact not being unnatural at all because our agency and our will are merely illusory, and so therefore everything is natural and we shouldn't complain about nuclear war or climate change or even the regular old homicide that happens down the street. It's all natural, and the entire conversation around natural and unnatural sort of just go away. Now, I think part of the reason we try to get at this is because in our modern enlightenment phase, the normative is really hard to come by. And that, again, is for all of the reasons Daniel Bonavac lays out in following Wilfred Sellers, that the manifest image and the scientific image differ fundamentally based on normativity. All scientific normativity is conditioned upon some outcome or goal. And if in fact, there is no outcome or goal that is natural to the world, then there is no normativity. All that there is. So we keep trying to get at the natural with something like evolutionary psychology. And so we go back and back and back. And we try to go to the far reaches of human agency, and at least to a point where at some place we can say, well, there's no serious human agency there at all. There's no more agency in human beings than there is in my dog or my cat, even though we'd better go back to the wolf. Or maybe if we can find some animal in the world that hasn't in one way or another been changed in their natural course of development from whatever it would be as if human beings have never been around. This brings up the very interesting communities that wish human beings would never be around again so everything could be natural once more. It sounds extremely odd, but when you think about this entire religious project of the natural, it makes perfect sense. So free will or choice are incidental or accidental, and it is the genocidal spelling bee, as Brett Weinstein calls it, of the genes doing the real work beneath the surface. All we are on top of the elephant are chattering riders, and the elephants basically never mind us at all. And now see Sam Adams' comment about Brett Weinstein and Gnosticism. It is almost as if at least an immoral God created the universe, and we as somehow the unnatural moral little gods are deciding what is good and what is best for us. But then again, in a purely pragmatic sphere, what is best for us isn't necessarily good, and it certainly isn't natural. So the scientific vision isn't normative. It's morality free, and we're just passing ad hoc judgments. And yet, as C.S. Lewis notes of many of his contemporaries, judge we do, and judge we feel we must. Now, in terms of the male genocidal spelling bee, our champion is Genghis Khan. At least that's the champion that we can put a name on that is at least within the history of civilization, whose genetic material we can reliably seem to trace all the way back to him as a definite historical individual whose story we know something of. Now, we hear the same story all the time. Men, these are human beings with penises and gonads and testosterone that provide the sperm, men or their genes want to multiply themselves as much as they can. And all of this stuff that we're doing and talking and thinking is basically all in the service of our gonads and our genes in terms of wanting to replicate ourselves again and again and again and again and again in the world. And of course, Genghis Khan is our champion. But because of the human gestation and the strenuous requirements to actually raise a child into a functional adult Homo sapien, child rearing is tremendously demanding. And so it makes sense to go all Genghis Khan on the world and, well, have lots of wives and do a little bit of raping and impregnating and, you know, any way you can get it done. And perhaps, you know, little reports that we hear sometimes, some of the most successful people have been offering their seed to sperm banks. Now, there's an adaptive strategy for the male genocidal spelling bee, but we'll keep Genghis Khan as our mascot for now. Now, the female genocidal spelling bee, well, women need to pass on their material and they need men in order to do it. And so what makes sense for women to do? Well, they want to secure, they peel off the top. As Jordan Peterson likes to say, they watch men vote each other up the hierarchy and they say, I'll pick that one. Seems healthy, seems virile, seems strong, seems powerful, seems very high status. And if I can, I'll secure exclusive rights to that man and I will have as many children with that man as I possibly can. Makes good sense. And what even makes more sense is to somehow secure the man's power. And if you can get exclusive rights to the man's power, to the man's wealth, to the man's status, then, well, all of your offspring will be blessed. To the degree that she can keep the man exclusively, she's got a competitive advantage over all of her rivals in terms of not only his genetic material, but all of the goods and services that his high status could furnish. Now, we see this story again and again in history. Very high status males tend to try to multiply the number of women in their life that they have sexual access to, and the women try to reduce that number, and back and forth they go again and again and again. And if you're playing this game, maybe this is the only game of human history, right here with the genocidal spelling bees of men against women. This is where I arrive at the title of my video. Jesus, Paul, and the Church want to control men's bodies, their sexuality, and autonomy. I get this line from my conversation with JP and John Vervaeke, where someone comes in and says, ha, Vanderclay, you just had to bash women. My genetics made me do it, I guess. You know, damn well, the Church wants to control women's bodies. Now, I have a whole nother set of thoughts that maybe I'll put into another video about that sentence itself, because I think that sentence basically betrays naturalism, because please show me the brain where the motivation within the material consciousness of the Church lies that has the motivation to control women's bodies. Or is this in fact, are you attesting to a disembodied spirit that has motivation and acts through history and moves people unaware, such as the Iowa farmer plants and moves the corn, and the corn knows little or nothing about him? That's the whole spirituality question. But I want to focus on the title of this slide. It's a historic reality, she claims. You have said you are not concerned that women are denied leadership positions in the Church. You don't think you know my position on this at all, and you can ask, and you can just ask the conservative members of my channel about my deficiencies in some of these areas. And you've said women have power insofar as they can tell their husbands how they feel. No, I think they got way more power than that. And their husbands can decide on how to use that info. I'll tell you something about some complementarian churches. I have had many pastors tell me that in the context of an all-male council meeting, you'll have a male elder, when it comes to a difficult question, say, "Well, pastor, I think I'll have to pray about this." The pastor whips out his cell phone and says, "Well, why don't you call your wife right now?" Because, well, if the man is the head, the woman is the neck, and she's doing a lot of turning. It is not anywhere near so simple as controlling women's bodies. And I think if you're looking at who Jesus, Paul, and the church have really tried to control, not always successfully, it's been men's bodies, their sexuality, and their autonomy through the course of the church. Oh, sure, put men up at the top of the church leadership hierarchy. But I'll tell you, go into just about any church, and if you cross the women pretty quickly, you won't have a church and not a lot will get done. These dynamics are far more nuanced and far more complex than just these simplistic narratives, which again are anti-materialistic or naturalistic. Well, why do I say this? Begin with an enormous departure from humanity's natural state. And if you want to read about this or listen to this, listen to Tom Wright and Tom Holland on their video on Unbelievable talk about Paul and the Roman world. What Paul tells men to do is absolutely unnatural, that they must somehow love their wives and give themselves up for their wives. And in fact, a little bit later on in the New Testament, Paul wants church leaders to be the husband of one wife. What Paul and Jesus and the church set into motion is probably the most successful male reproductive limitation strategy the world has ever seen. This has been the most powerful attempt to control male bodies, their sexuality, and their autonomy for all of human history. Now, I'll leave it to you to decide if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I frankly think this is much more of a historical fact. Now, men were to be exclusive to their wives, and this has always been a hard thing for men to do because, again, if we're playing the evolutionary psychology game, this is a difficult thing for men because supposedly it's unnatural to us. We're not wired this way. We're meant to spread our seed, and of course a man can spread his seed if not interrupted by science or some other awkward situation. Man should be able to spread his seed many, many, many times up to the limit of Genghis Khan. But Jesus seems to be almost the anti-Genghis Khan when it comes to these things. Male, female for life is an achievement of Christianity of monumental proportions, and it is simply so baked into our culture and our moral assumptions that we don't notice it at all anymore. Now, again, to get back to Sun Tzu, as I mentioned in my last video, that is the definition of smart conquest. Jesus, Paul, and the church pulled it off to the degree that men like me not only agree, but promote the idea. That's complete conquest and colonization of your rivals. And, well, for some reason, for some people, this is why some of those people say, well, this is why the church is more popular with women than with men. We let the men wear the hats and have the titles and do all the talking, and the women just sit back and say, we're benefiting from this scheme. Surely Paul and Jesus weren't married, but they seem to be on team women. Now, shall we decide to reject this desired control and return to the natural? That seems to be out in the air. Jordan Peterson talks about enforced monogamy. Most of the enforcement goes against men. And he's not saying that there's a government program for it. He's saying this has been so deeply built up into our moral assumptions, we don't even pay attention to it anymore. Do we really want to have natural sexuality the way we have natural foods? Well, I think we would probably have a better chance at it, given what we've done with natural and organic foods. Monogamy is mostly enforced in service of female genocidal spelling bee, if we play those games. Men have found, however, it sort of works for us too. That's a happy discovery. But I think we can thank for that happy discovery, well, this very unnatural way that the Jews, who basically give their orientation towards sexuality to Jesus and Paul, who tighten it down yet more notches further, and the church that has deployed it through the centuries. So, not a three-hour video, just a few comments. I don't even know how long this is, but it's a pretty short one. Sorry about that.